Retina Rounds, podcast number 25. Posterior segment manifestations of ocular trauma are some of the most challenging cases for vitreoretinal specialists to manage. Today, we're absolutely thrilled to welcome an ocular trauma and vitreoretinal specialist to Retina Rounds, Dr. David Lozano-Herral. Dr. Lozano-Herral is director of the Ocular Trauma Service at the Stein Eye Institute at UCLA, where he's also an assistant professor of ophthalmology in the retina division. Dr. Lozano shares his path to ophthalmology and pearls for ocular trauma management. Let's check it out.
So welcome, everybody, to our weekly Retina Rounds podcast. We're honored to have Dr. David Lozano-Herral, who is an assistant professor at UCLA's Jules Stein Eye Institute. David's story is a fascinating one, and he's a ocular trauma expert, as well as a diabetic retinopathy and vitreoretinal surgeon expert. And David, welcome to Retina Rounds. Thank you for joining us.
Steve, thank you so much for having me. It is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
It's really great to have you here. Let's tell our listeners a little bit about your life story. Where are you from, and how did you get into medicine?
Sure. So I'm originally from Mexico City. I was raised in Mexico City. My mom's side, especially her paternal side, they're all from Europe, from Spain, actually. And then, you know, they immigrated to Mexico City during the Spanish Civil War. That's where my mom was born. And same kind of story with my father. Ever since I was a little kid, I was always, you know, surrounded by ophthalmology. Both my dad and his father are vitreoretinal surgeons as well. Both practicing in Mexico City. My grandfather doesn't practice anymore, but they were both trained in my grandfather was trained in fully in the United States, both for residency, medical school, and as well for fellowship. And my father was able to complete his medical training in Mexico City and then come over to California to kind of wrap up his fellowship training as well. So ever since I was a small kid, I was always, you know, surrounded by medicine and especially eyes, which was kind of what sparked my interest for ophthalmology. I grew up in a city that's very we can call it a cosmopolitan city, very kind of, it's a mixture, kind of like Los Angeles, a lot of different cultures. So I had a pretty good kind of diverse cultural experience growing up, both at the school where I got my education, a bilingual school. It was an American school. So that's where I kind of was able to learn English and be able to practice it as I was, you know, moving forward with my studies. But it wasn't until I was about 12 or 13 years old, maybe even a little older than that, that my father kind of, you know, pushed us, both my brother and I, to work during our summers. He would always push us to, you know, the first part of the summer, always look for a job opportunity and then be able to relax. And the last part of the summer, be able to just have fun. So one of my first kind of interests in terms of, you know, diving into the job experience was, you know, I'd like to know what you do and kind of experience a day or a few weeks at your hospital and kind of, you know, get related to the medical situation. I was never interested in doing medicine. I always kind of even laughed about it with my dad and saying, you know, I'll never follow your footsteps. I was kind of much more interested in you know, law and finance, maybe other stuff that had nothing to do with medicine. But it wasn't until that summer that I was actually, you know, surrounded by patients and surgeons and being able to, you know, have surgical exposure and be able to watch and observe the, you know, vitreoretinal surgeries and trauma surgeries. It was then and there where I said, you know, this is, I really felt a calling and felt the natural interest, nothing to do with both my dad and his dad being retinal surgeons. That was where it was a natural and genuine interest for the specialty. And that's where I said, you know, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And that's where I really felt a calling, you know.
So I have some recollection of a story of you being like a orderly at the hospital that summer, like you were, you know, pushing patients around and taking out moving things around, taking out the garbage and things like that. And somebody thought you were a resident and took you into surgery.
Yes.
Is that a correct recollection?
That is. And I'd like to, you know, kind of expand on that story, because it was that surgeon who is Emiliano Fulda. He's a vitreoretinal surgeon and oncology expert in Mexico City, one of the best, actually. He was finishing up his fellowship while I was doing all of these kind of transfers. I was transferring patients from the pre-op area over to the operating rooms.
So, and how old were you?
I was probably 14 years old.
And what happened?
And so he saw me. I was dressed up with a face mask. I had my, you know, my surgical gown, and I was kind of dressed up to be able to transfer the patients over to them, to the OR. And he kind of he mistook me for a medical student, I guess. And it was after hours. He needed an extra pair of hands to help him, you know, squirt the eye with water, maybe hold the lens, do basic stuff. So he told me, you know, who are you rotating with, right? He asked me about my rotation, and I said, well, I'm rotating with the people that are taking the patients to the operating room. And he couldn't understand what I was saying, so I pulled down the mask, and he kind of, okay, I totally see you're not, you know, old enough to be a medical student. So he asked, you know, who I was, and you know, I told him the reason for me being there. And then he said, well, do you know anything about medicine? And I said, unfortunately, no. And then his next question was, do you know how to wash your hands? And I said, yes. So he said, perfect. That's all we need for now. He showed me how to scrub in. He showed me how to, you know, put on some gloves. And that's the moment where I said, wow, this is really something that is, I've never felt that adrenaline. I'd never felt that kind of, you know, that spark, that calling. And, you know, being able to work with him over those two cases, that it was it from there. You know,
And was it traumatic for you?
It was in a certain way, it was, because you know, the cases that I got to see and got to assist were you know, vitreoretinal cases. We know that those you know, not always have good outcomes, and unfortunately, the patient that we were operating on, and I say we, because I was just really squirting water, had an open globe surgery, which they were you know, closing then and there. Because back home and in the institute, and we'll talk about that later, vitreoretinal surgeons are, or fellows are, the ones that are in charge of the trauma service and closing these open globes. So I was able to see my first surgical intervention and kind of see my first ophthalmology surgery was an open globe surgery. So it was traumatic in the sense that I never thought those could look, because I always had the sense that, you know, ophthalmology was super clean, almost no bleeding. Vitreoretinal surgery is kind of like neurosurgery, where we're doing very microsurgical maneuvers, which are very clean. And this was quite the opposite, right? So it was, wow, it was traumatic in the sense that it really opened my eyes in terms of, wow, there's much more to the eye than just, you know, microsurgery. So that was something that really kind of marked me, and kind of in the best way possible, you know. So definitely a good experience, both traumatic in the sense that it opened my eyes to, wow, this is no joke, and in the sense that it really inspired me to want to delve into medicine for sure.
And then you went to medical school in Mexico City?
Correct. So I was probably a couple of years from having to really decide what I wanted to do in terms of, you know, back in Mexico, we don't do college. We go straight into university programs in terms of, you know, if you want to go to law, you go straight into law. If you want to go into medicine, you go straight into medicine. So, and there is kind of a pre-medical program that you have to take, like a 6-month course, to be able to kind of qualify and be able to apply for a medical school position. So after that experience and after that summer, the mindset was it's going to be medicine, and not only that, it's going to be ophthalmology for sure. So you know, the last couple of years in high school, I was kind of getting my mindset ready to be able to apply to med school and be able to pass that pre-med program. So yes, it was in Universidad Anáhuac, which is in Mexico City. It's a private university. And we have a lot of clinical exposure as well in all of the national institutes, big volume institutes, huge reference centers for everything you can think of, in every level of expertise. So from small clinics all the way to third level institutions. So, and then of course, residency in Mexico City as well.
Yeah, and Mexico City, for our listeners who haven't had the chance to visit, has a super sophisticated medical community, and particularly a super sophisticated ophthalmology and vitreoretinal community. Tell our listeners a little bit about the main hospitals in eye hospitals in Mexico City, and how they. It's always struck me as remarkably collegial. Everybody gets along extremely well. Patients are shared extremely well. And the innovation that's come out of there and the expertise and the level of care is superb. And I think that collegiality combined with the expertise is what leads to such good outcomes. But tell us a little bit about the lay of the land, the different hospitals, and maybe frame the size of Mexico City so people can understand what an enormous place it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, first and foremost, Mexico City is probably the largest metropolitan city, or one of the largest in Latin America and probably in the world. Very, very big, chaotic in a good and a bad way, both chaotic in terms of there's a lot going on, but there's, a lot of things that overpopulation, we have to cater to that as well. So to answer your question, in terms of ophthalmology particularly, there's three main institutes for ophthalmology dedicated exclusively to eye care in Mexico City, which is Instituto de Oftalmología Conde de Valenciana, Asociación para Evitar la Ceguera en México, which is APEC, and Hospital de Nuestra Señora de la Luz, or Hospital de la Luz, which are three, like I said, institutes that are devoted exclusively to eye care and that have every piece of technology and every piece of funding, let's call it that, to be able to take care of underserved populations. They're private hospitals in the sense that the people that we take care of have to pay a certain fee to have to be able to receive this care, but it's an astronomical difference between what they pay there, in a difference between a private sector. So these three main institutions are both private, but they're academic in the sense that they're training residents, they're training medical students, they're training fellows, not only from Mexico City, but from all over the country, and as well, medical students, residents, and fellows from all over Latin America. And this is because these three main institutes that have had an amazing leadership over the last 100 years, both APEC and Hospital de Nuestra Señora de Luz, have been active for more than 100 years. Instituto de Oftalmología en Conde de Valenciana for about 50 years. So there's been an amazing leadership in trying to kind of concentrate the population that we take care of in these three institutes, because there's a lot of general hospitals that take care of ophthalmology as well. But it's these three main institutes that have been kind of the leading force and the tip of the spear for research, for academic training, and of course, for good outcomes and quality care for our patients. So, and the relationship and this kind of the symbiotic relationship in these three institutes, not only at the level of the management, but also at a level of residents, med school students, attendings, sharing patients, sharing knowledge. One of the things that we take a lot of pride on is we love to get together in our national meetings and talk about new approaches for surgery, new approaches for research, new approaches on how to take care of our patients, everything you can think of. So that is something that has united us a lot. Back in the day, there was much more of a competitive kind of relationship, which not always leads to, favorable relationships that lead to a healthy, symbiotic relationship where we can share knowledge, we can share patients. And now, over the past couple of decades, and thanks to people like Hugo Quiroz and Virgilio Morales, and a lot of people that are up there in these institutions have helped put out, not only put the name of these institutions out there at an international level, but also help bring us together as a community and be able to work together to, enhance and improve the name of the Mexican kind of medicine and
Yeah,
what we're
you
doing.
left out the of the three musketeers of leadership in retina. You left out the name of what's that guy's name again? Your
Well,
father?
this is there are in management. This is something that's a good segue to first and foremost the Graue doctors, which are Enrique Graue and Federico Graue, which is the these are both some of the most important figures in Mexican ophthalmology, not only being able to institutionalize these hospitals. They are the leading force in both making the Instituto de Oftalmología happen and being able to manage and push forward with the Instituto of Nuestra Señora de la Luz, which is one of the, if not the oldest, ophthalmology institute in Latin America. So their hard work has led to people like my father, David Lozano, who has always had a thriving focus to be able to manage. He's the actual chair right now in ophthalmology for the Instituto de Oftalmología Conde de Valenciana, and his work has also helped, put the name of the institute out there and help bring in more funding and to be able to have better research and be able to have better quality of care and more technology and expand and have more centers and do kind of what Stein Eye is doing and expand and be able to broaden our focus for sure.
Yeah, the Graues are amazing. I think I saw Federico at the recent ASRS meeting here in Long Beach, and it was so great to greet him and see him smiling along with so many of the other colleagues from Mexico City who attended. But you're exactly right. The collegiality does synergize the outcomes, not just for patients. The other thing that struck me is you mentioned the three main eye hospitals, but a lot of the larger district general hospitals are now employing really good vitreoretinal surgeons who are handling either the diabetes clinic, like I think David Rivera and Valentina Franco. I can't remember if they're at the institutes as well or if they're at the bigger community or civ general hospitals, both doing a great job. And another one of our former fellows is Vidal Soberón, and I think he's as well both at one of the institutes and one of the community hospitals. Am I recalling that correctly?
That is correct. And I've always liked to say that I'm standing in the shoulders of giants, specifically of these three amazing retina specialists, which are Valentina Franco, which had the opportunity to be a vitreoretina international fellow at Steinei back in 2010, then David Rivera in 2013, and then before me, Vidal Soberón in 2018. And the three of them have just had fantastic careers, both academically and professionally. Starting by with Valentina Franco, she's one of the leading, forces in vitreoretinal surgery in Mexico City and Mexico in general, and probably Latin America. Her expertise have, translated into surgical training for fellows and residents. She's an active attending right now at the Instituto de Oftalmología Conde de Valenciana, and she's there staffing retina surgeries, and she's there with them in the wet labs and helping them thrive in surgery. And she's been an amazing leader in terms of research as well, and a voice of this research that she's been doing in Instituto de Oftalmología Conde de Valenciana over the past decade or so. And she's been very outspoken in all of these national and international meetings. Then David Rivera, he's been amazing at being able to lead the diabetic retinopathy and just the diabetic department at one of the biggest institutes for national health in Latin America, which is the Instituto de Nutrición Salvador Subirán. Very big, very well-renowned institute for medicine in general. And he's been the leading force there in being able to, create a program for early detection for diabetic retinopathy. So that's a huge effort. He's also an attending at a Instituto de Oftalmología Conde de Valenciana and has a very thriving practice in Mexico City as well. And lastly, Vidal Soberón, an amazing, amazing vitreoretina surgeon as well. A little older than me, kind of on the younger side as well. But again, one of the leading forces in ocular oncology, specifically for vitreoretinal lymphoma and retinoblastoma and choroidal melanoma. He had the opportunity to do his training with you guys as well, and at Jules Stein and with Dr. Tara McCannell, and brought back all of that expertise to Mexico City. He's now a very well-renowned attending at APEC, at Institute at Asociación para Evitar la Ceguera en México. And he has a thriving private practice as well, and one of the best young surgeons out there right now, and very well spoken, very knowledgeable in everything retina and oncology. He's been amazing at giving out, putting us out there as a good leading force for oncology, at least in
So
Latin America.
one of the great things about the vitreoretinal community in Mexico City is the besides the collegiality, is the incredible hospitality. So on behalf of your entire hometown's vitreoretinal community, I'm inviting you to invite all of our listeners to visit Mexico City because I think they'll find it to be an amazing place culturally. And a lot to learn from the medical community there. Does that feel like a safe invitation for you?
Oh, definitely. And I thank you so much for giving me the space to be able to invite everyone to visit Mexico City, not only for Mexico in general, but Mexico City, which is where I'm from, lately. And I think this is no news, but Mexico City has been quite popular now for, restaurants, and kind of a very, very cool place to go. There's a lot of very nice restaurants. There's a lot of amazing museums. It's full of culture. The people are so, like you said, the hospitality there is amazing. And I think in to specifically answer your question, the medical community in general is just so inviting, and we love to have people and world experts from all over the world, and international fellows that have been, that have trained with you guys at Stein as well, and at UCLA from Japan and Israel and Peru and Argentina, which has an amazing group of leading ophthalmologists and vitreoretinal surgeons as well, and the Brazilian community and the Peruan community, Uruguay. I mean, I can't say enough about all of these Latin countries and European countries that have been working hard to be able to, send their trainees abroad and have, an influx of very capable people. So for Mexico City specifically, I think that, we've been working hard in having a lot of meetings that invite national and international experts. So, and we usually like to really, really take care of you guys and give you guys good meetings at the beach and, good parties. And we're famous for having
Unbelievable.
good parties. That's no question. You can ask Hugo Quiroz. Anyone who knows Hugo Quiroz will have a nice time, and he's one of the most hospitable and welcoming Mexican physicians that I know. So.
Well, it's the combination of great hospitality and great work. Like, there's always something valuable to learn from, whether it's Virgilio or Hugo or Lozano Sr. Or, I remember a paper your father did on giant retinal tears. And that work really helped galvanize the way that we approach giant retinal tears today. And he really synthesized and answered some really important questions. So let's shift gears now to where you're at now. You're now an associate professor at UCLA. You've did your fellowship at UCLA, and we were thrilled to have you there. And you've decided to stay on at UCLA, and you're heading up the ocular trauma service, as well as doing some really advanced adaptive optics work on the macula. Let's talk a little bit about ocular trauma and how you're rewriting the local approach to ocular trauma at UCLA. There's a lot of ocular trauma at UCLA. It's a big network. It's a big city, Los Angeles. And just like in most major metropolitan cities, ocular trauma tends to funnel to just a couple of institutions. So, talk about how you've reorganized the trauma service, and I'm looking forward to hearing about it.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for asking, Steve. When I was invited to stay on as a faculty member, both at the retina division and as the director of the ocular trauma, I was very excited to kind of rebuild the ocular trauma service at UCLA, which was something that the department really wanted me to work on, specifically at Ronald Reagan Medical Center. The big focus was on creating a system that works around the clock. As we all know, trauma, and as you very well said right now, doesn't arrive on a schedule, right? So, we needed to have clear and better pathways for triage and for how the ER and the residents and faculty communicate amongst each other, and of course for how patients get to the operating rooms quickly when an open globe comes in. And to be honest, just having that reliable structure in place has really improved outcomes over the last 2 or 3 years that we've been, really and tirelessly working on this. And in terms of on the training side, we've worked hard to kind of strike a balance between giving residents meaningful surgical experience and also making sure patients are getting the best possible care. And what I've been trying to set up is a kind of a sort of graduated responsibility model where residents get hands-on practice in wet labs and simulation settings first. We're really trying hard to implement those first. And then when they're in the operating rooms, they're the primary surgeon as much as possible. And that's something that I've been kind of working a lot with the fellows and the other faculty members that are staffing these cases, is that we're trying to always having faculty scrubbed in and guiding the residents, and also do a lot of debriefing afterwards, reviewing cases, talking about what went well and what we could improve. And this is to better enhance the training for the residents without compromising quality care for our patients, and the nice
So
thing is that.
let's talk about a couple of specific instances. So an open globe comes in, and there is also some intraocular pathology that will need to be addressed surgically. For example, a retinal detachment or vitreous hemorrhage. Are you of the philosophy that that should be fixed at the primary repair, or should that be fixed later? And what is your, every case is individual. I understand that, our listeners understand that, but in general, are you close the eye, deal with it in a more controlled setting later, or you fix everything you can at the first setting?
Yeah, our approach has been evidence-based almost entirely, and we're using the ocular trauma score. We're using protocols and algorithms that have worked at other institutions. And to answer your question more concretely, the answer would be no. Our philosophy is we're just trying to close the eye. We're trying to restore the normal ocular anatomy. We're trying to avoid the patient from having, intraocular anatomy extruding. We're trying to avoid endophthalmitis, and we're trying to avoid the patient losing the globe, the eye,
So
right?
are you typically placing periocular or intraocular antibiotics at the time of an open globe, as well as are you dealing with intravenous antibiotics or not?
We are part of our protocol. As soon as a patient comes in, we can confirm there's an open globe. We're doing intravenous a dose of antibiotic intravenously at the emergency department, and then we're doing subconj and in some cases intravitreal antibiotics as well. And in some cases, we're sending patients with oral antibiotics home as well.
So when a patient comes into the emergency room with an open globe, what type of antibiotics do they get?
Usually broad spectrum. We're usually using levofloxacin or ciprofloxacin. This is what has been shown to work and reduce the incidence and the occurrence of endophthalmitis. And I'm happy and proud to say we've probably done a couple hundred or more than 200 cases over the past 2 or 3 years, and we haven't had a single case of endophthalmitis. So I think
That's
that
great.
has shown to work well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And what is the protocol for the emergency room in terms of what you recommend for evaluation? So a patient comes in with a rule-out ruptured globe, either the eye is swollen shut, there's a mechanism, or they can actually see it. Are they getting some imaging for you as the eye team is activated, or do you wait for the eye team to get there to activate the imaging? And then what sort of imaging do you typically get? In the emergency room, if any.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So, as soon as a patient comes in, our first and foremost intervention is having the float resident, normally the PGY2 residents, have them do a thorough and extensive first interrogate the patient, get every piece of information that we can get of, previous ocular history, systemic condition, et cetera, and then do a very, very well-guided ocular exam at the slit lamp, even before thinking about, imaging. That will give us a good idea of what we're up against, right? Is this something that needs surgery immediately? Are we not sure? Is this something that is really evident as an open globe? So that will kind of dictate what type of imaging we're going to ask for. Patients that have Every patient will get a CT scan. That's no doubt. First, we're looking for orbital fractures, of course, that could modify our approach or our intervention. Second, we're looking for the presence of a deflated globe or an open globe to confirm that first. And then, of course, we're looking for any evidence of intraocular foreign bodies. So that's kind of the first things or the first package of imaging that we're looking for. We're not performing B scans there because we're not wanting to put pressure on the eye, of course. But it's mainly CT scans and whenever possible, a B scan if we're sure the eye is completely intact and there's no
And
sign of
are you using a plain film X-ray as well to help rule out intraocular foreign bodies, or are you satisfied that the CT scan can see everything?
Normally, we've been pretty satisfied and we've been able to diagnose intraocular foreign bodies just by using the CT scan. We haven't had the need to rely on those
But
X-rays.
can you rule them out?
That's a great question. Yes, we've almost in every case been able to rule out intraocular foreign body. There hasn't been a case where we diagnose a patient with no intraocular foreign body, and then at the time of surgery, either on the first intervention or at the time of the vitreoretinal surgery, we haven't had a surprise where, wow, we thought there wasn't an intraocular body on the CT scan, and now there is one on surgery.
And
So.
have you set up a protocol for how the ER docs deal with this? Do they have a template for to suspect a ruptured globe? The ER docs are very sophisticated.
Definitely.
When I was there, we used to have them put a shield on and not do anything and wait for the eye doctor to get there. And then we had some that were, oh, this is cool. Let us do something. It would take to gynae ultrasound and start ultrasounding the globe and try and make the diagnosis before we get there. So have you set up a protocol for to do and not to do stuff for
Yes.
the ER docs?
Definitely, yes. So every time, and we've kind of established guidelines where they're giving us a call first, and they're kind of walking us through what they're looking at there, and then based on our discussion, we can tell them if we need them to perform X or Y diagnostic testing either before referral, or you know what, just put a shield on, do not touch the eye, and send them over.
That's great. So communication is the key.
That is correct. We're always, and that is kind of the first point in us rebuilding this ocular trauma service is communication between emergency departments, between physicians, and between departments. And that is what ultimately allows us to have timely interventions and good visual outcomes. So definitely educating the emergency doctors, which are not, you know, normally that familiar with ocular pathology, educating them in terms of less is more in these particular cases, or do not touch the eye because you could end up, you know, doing more harm, is essential. And I think
Right. So
we're
our
getting better.
audience here at Retina Rounds is very much the full spectrum of expertise. And a lot of our listeners are early in their career. So what are you teaching now in 2025 about how to handle prolapsed uvea? So you've got a group of six or eight absolutely genius first or second year residents who are going to rotate through the trauma service. They're obviously going to be well attended by either vitreoretinal fellows or cornea fellows or glaucoma fellows on the trauma service. They're going to have attendings with them, but you're teaching them how to deal with this surgery, not just telling them to go read about it. What are you telling them specifically about how to deal with prolapsed uvea? Let's just say, for the sake of discussion, iris in one instance and maybe choroid or ciliary body in another instance.
Perfect. And I think that's a perfect question in terms of what residents struggle the most during our open globe cases. And it's exactly that, you know. And what I try to focus on in terms of teaching residents about that specific question is, number one, fundamentals. Surgical fundamentals is what will make these residents proficient, not only for ocular trauma, but for everything surgical in terms of ophthalmology. So my philosophy is, if we have good basic fundamentals, this means being able to do a very good preoperative exam. Second, being very familiar with the instruments that we're using, surgical instrument, what to use which instrument for goes a very long way for ocular trauma. What type of forceps we're using to grab the cornea, to grab the conjunctiva, the sclera, and even the choroid or the iris. So fundamentals are basic, learning how to be respectful to the ocular anatomy, being respectful to ocular tissues is basic and crucial for them to be able to really deal with prolapsed tissue. So that's the first thing. Second is having good basic knowledge on ocular dissection and how to dissect the tissues even before thinking about how to reposition an iris or how to deal with a bleeding choroid or a protruded choroid. We have to first learn how to dissect tissue around the cornea, around the limbus, around the sclera, around the muscles, and detect the extent of the injuries first, even before we get creative. And we know we like to get creative, and there's types of ocular surgeries that have a specific recipe, like maybe cataract and maybe vitreoretinal surgery and trauma surgery. It's where we can, quote unquote, get creative, right? And have different approaches, which will have different outcomes. And that's something that I'm always very adamant about with the residents is anything or everything you do will have a repercussion, good or bad. So for instance, a prolapsed iris, the prolapsed iris you could deal with in a minute or 2 minutes, or you could be fighting the iris, a prolapsed iris, for an hour. And everyone watching here knows that. So having good fundamentals on, first and foremost, is the iris peaking from the cornea? Is it peaking from the limbus? Is it protruding from the sclera? Is it bleeding? Has it been protruded for more than 24 hours? Does it have a biofilm over it covering that, you know, could talk about bacterial proliferation? So all of those first visual features that the residents are looking at will help them kind of make decisions about, am I going to reposition? Am I going to reintroduce this iris into the anterior chamber? Am I going to try to push the bleeding choroid back into the eye and close, or am I going to try to excise this tissue? So I'm always very careful in teaching them what needs to be removed from the eye, necrotic tissue, extremely damaged or prolapsed iris that will make no sense to reposition, how to reposition. You know, something that I always like to show them is, we as we're early in our training, we think that putting visco in the interior, this is an example, putting visco in the interior chamber will be our best friend in terms of pushing everything back and creating space for us to be able to throw on sutures or at least reposition the iris. But they learn sometimes in the bad way that putting excessive amounts of visco in the eye will work against us by pushing and burping that iris out, right? So they're learning how to deal with the anterior chamber without always having to rely on viscoelastic. So learning how to make paracentesis, learning how to use different instruments to sweep the iris, learning how to be able to very carefully and elegantly excise prolapse or necrotic or infected pieces of iris or choroid is basic in their training. And that's something that I always kind of take time and teaching them as we're doing this. For example, choroid. Whenever they're dissecting the conjunctiva and there's tenons that's kind of helping us tamponade that choroid, whenever we dissect and remove that tenons, we open Pandora, right? We see that profuse bleeding, we lose visualization, we're no longer able to, throw sutures as good as we would on a dry setting. So that kind of gets residents nervous. I can't see what I'm doing. So I'm teaching them how to enhance their visualization first. Then how to assess the prolapsed tissue. All right, you're up against a prolapsed choroid. So first, is there any vitreous associated with that, right? How to deal with that? Is the choroid healthy enough for us to be able to reposition that back into the eye? If the answer is yes, all right, what's the safest way to do this? Is the choroid, has the choroid been exposed for more than 24 hours or 48 hours? Is there a bacterial biofilm or is there necrosis, something that might cause
So, David, you're hitting on some really interesting guidelines. So, if it's a relatively fresh injury, let's say under 6 hours, it sounds like you're in favor, in the absence of any really negative signs, you're in favor of repositing the tissue.
100%.
And if it's been exposed for 36 hours, it's a harder question, but it's sort of on the other end of the spectrum. You're still repositing if you can, particularly the choroid, I would imagine.
I tend to individualize these cases. If there was good tenons and conch closure, meaning sometimes we're not sure if it's even an open globe, because everything younger patients have very tight and broadly adhered tenons and conjunctiva, which could kind of, give us a false idea in terms of that. So we've had the instance where maybe the eye has been open for a week, but it's been well protected by both tenons and conjunctiva. And when we open, we know for a fact that this might have been exposed for more than 24 or 36 hours, but it looks healthy enough. There's no sign of infection. There's no sign of necrosis. The bleeding looks, not as profuse. Then we'll kind of decide then and there. But in the vast majority of cases, when there is an evident open globe with evident slit lamp exam that shows evident prolapse of the tissue, if it's less than 24 hours, I'm much more of the philosophy of repositioning that iris or
One other
that
very
choroid.
basic question, sorry for interrupting. One other very basic question that comes up a lot, not just on retina rounds, but what sort of anesthetic are you using for trauma cases? So an open globe, what are you using local anesthesia, peribulbar anesthesia, general anesthesia, lack of a paralytic? What talk to us about what the recommendations are for the anesthesiologist, because just like at every big center, a lot of anesthesiologists don't deal with that. Some deal with a lot of ocular trauma, but some have never dealt with it. And so it's always important to have a discussion with the anesthesiologist. What are you recommending typically from the anesthesia standpoint for the open globe surgery, whether it's exploration or repair?
Great question. So, in terms of just patient safety, we're always relying on general anesthesia, and this is to avoid, doing a retrobulbar block and putting more pressure on an already open globe, or just, if there's an if there's a orbital fracture and we're putting in a retrobulbar, we could cause any sort of harm. So we're always just in that particular sense, we're always just pushing for general anesthesia. And then, of course, most of these patients are elderly patients or maybe patients that are under the influence of substance or maybe patients that are not cognitive, not function functionally cognitive, don't have an adequate cognitive function. So in terms of just compliance, it helps us as well. But first and foremost, we use general anesthesia to avoid putting more pressure on the eye.
Any particular types that you do or
We
you don't want?
We usually, and every case, they ask us, do you want paralysis? And I usually say yes. And this is just to have a better and more controlled, surgical setting. I'm not fully aware, and I would like to kind of look more into that because I'm not sure what medications they're using to put these patients under. But I just know that we're kind of 99.9% of our cases, we tend to push for general anesthesia,
Great.
unless the patient can't have it. And we've had the one or two cases where we've done it under just either topical or a retrobulbar because there's no other way of undoing it, but it's the very rare case.
That's great. Let's shift gears to your imaging research, which has been a project that you and I started together a long time ago, and you've carried on. And I'm so proud of it, and especially proud of you. Describe a little bit the questions you're asking with adaptive optics and looking for photoreceptors in the macula, and where that's going, and what those research projects are.
Of course. So, one of the main things that drew me to UCLA and to the retina department and your mentorship particularly was not only the stem cell program, but the diagnostic and the imaging aspect of the macular pathology, right? Specifically talking about geographic atrophy. So, and this is a project that I hold very, very dear to my heart because it's something that it's a project that combines, a lot of astronomy and physics and medicine. And just to kind of broadly talk about this is we're using a very nice, very futuristic modern camera that uses the same technology as the James Webb and Hubble telescopes to take very high quality pictures of the cosmos and the universe. Now we're using this technology that's been specifically designed for retina imaging to scan the retina, specifically areas of geographic atrophy. And just at first, we were just wanting to get good quality images of the areas of geographic atrophy and comparing them with normal photoreceptor cone mosaic and just seeing the difference of a healthy macula and a pathologic macula with geographic atrophy. Then, as we were using this technology more and more, we started seeing stuff that we're going to call it stuff that showed up on the camera that we were not sure if they were actual, photoreceptors. Are these cones? Are these dormant cones? Are these remnants of cones? Are these false positive? What is this that these hyperreflective things that we're looking at in these pictures that we're taking of geographic atrophy areas? Now that sparked the question and really got our interest in saying, should we start trying to focus more on these areas, maybe trying to target feasible areas for future treatment with stem cell therapy. So what we did was we had a group of patients with geographic atrophy, and we just took pictures of their atrophy areas, looking for these hyperreflective areas. And we had a very good surprise in the sense that every one of these patients have something that resembled the photoreceptor mosaic in some areas of those geographic atrophy areas. So it was interesting for us to see and kind of delve into the question, can we treat these areas and are these areas more feasible to get better in the future?
Yeah, that's fascinating work. And I don't know if the audience understands how hard that is, because using an adaptive optics camera, even the modern versions, even the ones that are in clinics in patients who can't fixate, is very challenging. And so it requires great energy, which you clearly have, as well as great patience and dedication to the project. And so, how many patients have you imaged now?
So I think I have maybe a little under 20 patients that we have reliable and good high definition quality pictures of their geographic atrophy.
Wow, over time.
Over time, yes, this is since 2022 when I started working in this project with you, and I've been able to share some of our preliminary results in some of very interesting meetings, and they've had very good feedback and very little pushback in the sense that this is not what we think it is. But the big question is, is this a false positive that the camera is picking up, or is this actually something that no one ever has ever imaged or has had the capability of imaging? And now with these adaptive optics and like flood illumination technology, we're able to see and enhance our therapeutic opportunities.
Yeah,
So.
well, one of the great things about being at UCLA is the great medical retina team that's there with David Seraph and Vas Sada, and they attract a fantastic world-leading cohort to UCLA every year for their International Imaging Symposium. I believe it's called the INTRIS meeting, which occurs in March, and I'm sure David and Vas won't mind if we wave the flag for that meeting and encourage people to attend. It's one of the great US side meetings for imaging gurus to come together. And I know I've watched you present this work there, and it's really great to leverage the global expertise that convenes on campus every year and be able to share those insights. And I'm delighted you're carrying on with the work and that it's going so well. So congratulations for that. David, one other question I have for you that is completely a change of pace is I know you're spending some time at the County Hospital in Los Angeles where you have the opportunity to interface with the indigenous Mexican population here in Los Angeles. And I know from my personal experience, both having worked there for many years, and it's a wonderful population of people, but also I know that it gives the patients an enormous sense of pride to have a Mexican doctor.
That
And
is.
I'm sure for you, it gives you goosebumps. It gives me goosebumps just thinking about what it must be like for you there. So share a little bit about that because this is a, forget about all the politics and everything else. This is a really wonderful population and it's a sophisticated group of people. And they, it, just share a little bit about it. It's got to be amazing, the stories
Of
there.
course, and it's so heartwarming to be asked this because it truly is such a privilege for me to be able to take care of underserved Latin. It's not only Mexican population, it's Latin population from all over Latin America, and I
Yeah,
can't
but
say.
I'm not talking about the immigrant population. I'm talking about the indigenous
Right.
Mexican
Yep.
people that are here. They've been in Los Angeles since it was before it was Los Angeles,
That's right.
and they are so proud to have a Mexican doctor. Just talk to me about, I know it's an honor for you. It's an
Yeah.
honor for all of us to get to work with that population, and it's there's I know there's a great sense of satisfaction for you, but I'm asking the opposite, like, okay, you're a good doctor, you're not a good doctor. We all know you're a great doctor. That's not what it's about. What I'm asking is share some of the stories about the when the patients when it clicks in
Perfect.
for them that you're
Perfect.
Mexican.
Perfect. Yeah,
It's
that
got to be unbelievable.
I think that's even a better question, Steve, and
Yeah.
something that I'll have a much better time answering because it does as soon as I introduce myself in Spanish and they hear the accent and their whole demeanor just changes, right? And it's in that moment where their guard drops, they're able to ask questions, they start smiling, they ask where I'm from, what soccer team are you rooting for? We talk about
Yeah, by the way, what soccer team are you rooting for?
Always UNAM, always Pumas, which is my alma mater for my
Yeah.
ophthalmology training, and
Yeah.
yeah, no doubt.
Lo siento, porque terrible, pero.
Yeah, they're not doing well recently, but the best team. There's no other team.
Okay, that's good. Now tell us about
But
the patients.
it's fantastic to be able to engage with these patients in my native language, which is Spanish, and just be able to give them, of course, good quality care and whatnot, but be able to give them that other part of medicine, which is the emotional and the empathic kind of side of doctors, right? Being able to hold their hand and being able to explain what they have, being able to reassure them sometimes, and being able to, in Spanish and being able to elaborate on how we can help them, why we're doing what we're doing, which some of these patients have been getting injections or having had procedures for the better part of a decade and not know why they've been. What they've been treating for, right? Or why they're getting what they're getting, or why they've been injected. And being able to answer all these questions in a fashion that they feel connected to with a doctor that they feel they can connect to in their native language, it's such a privilege for me, Steve. And I can't tell you how happy I am to be
I
able
know
to do
it's a
that.
privilege for you. It's one of the greatest things ever. Look, when I worked at Harvard and tried to speak Spanish, I'm sure I told patients, I cracked them up because I would tell them, I was trying to tell them, this is a very important surgery on your left eye. And I would be telling them that, you're going to have a big cheese sandwich tomorrow. So it's, they knew I was trying, but my Spanish improved over time there, but it was pretty terrible. But I'm not talking about that. Like, share one or two of the anecdotes of the patients clicking in and the
Perfect.
pride they feel when they know there's actually a Mexican national treating them in Los Angeles County. It's an amazing thing. And it's.
I have this very specific anecdote of this happened to me last week, actually. A patient that actually cried and was moved to tears just by li hearing that I'm a Mexican surgeon and Mexican doctor working at Harbor. So this is a patient that's been living in Los Angeles for the better part of 60 years, right? So he's been in and out of every type of institution you can think of. He's had every type of surgery, both, in his body and in his eyes. He's lost one eye to diabetes. He's fighting to save the vision on the other eye. And he's a very devoted man in terms of his health over the past decade or so, that he's now really taking care of his health. And he was asking about my training and about kind of what brought me to the United States. And a big part of my conversation with him was, I'm here because I want to be here for you guys and I want to serve this population. And he just started crying, right? And he stood up and gave me a hug and said, "You're the first Mexican doctor that I've ever met here in California, and I can tell you how moving that is to really know that there's thriving doctors from Mexico that can thrive in the United States as well, because we all know how hard it is to be able to enter the system here." And he was so moved and so touched by just the sheer fact that I was able to practice medicine in the United States, right? And we know how hard it is, and we're not even going to talk about that, but him being able to kind of acknowledge that and be moved to tears and really feel that and kind of relate to that struggle was amazing. It was truly heartwarming.
That's
And I have
just
another
incredible.
I have another one where
Let's hear it.
this patient that told me that every time he walked into a hospital here in the US, he's been here for maybe 15, 20 years, so he knows the kind of the system back home and the system here, right? And he told me that every time he walked at a hospital here, he's been treated at UCLA, he's been treated at Cedars-Sinai, and now taken care of at Harbor. So he's pretty familiar. He was always telling me how intimidated he was by the doctors and by having to speak in English and not being able to communicate in English sometimes and having to say yes to everything without really understanding. And as soon as I, told him I was from Mexico, he said, "And now I don't even want to talk about medicine. I want to talk about soccer, and I want you to tell me, how my home my sport is doing back home, and talk to me about the new artist." So we talked about everything other than medicine. No, so in the end, he just wanted to talk about how things were doing back home, because he hadn't had contact with Mexico probably over the better part of a couple decades. So that really moved me as well, be able to kind of connect, both countries by just a simple conversation at a hospital. That really moved me as well and kind of cemented my drive there, and my motivation to be there. So,
Well, if you think about being in a foreign country and needing medical care and not speaking the language, it's intimidating for anybody. And then when you run into somebody who is from your home, even your ancestors' home, it's amazing. You might remember many years ago, I was lecturing in Mexico City, and one of the questions was, this was maybe it's 15 or 20 years ago now. The questions was about which anti-VEGF, if you lived in Mexico, which anti-VEGF agent would you use as a first-line treatment for this patient? And I said, well, I do live in Mexico. And the group, it was at the big hotel in Mexico City where often the Congress is there. The group went wild. And it's true because, Los Angeles, California was a part of Mexico before it was a part of the United States. And there are a lot of indigenous people here. And we have a very diverse population and we're proud to have it. It makes us better. But the interface of it going the other way, of having, you have what the position you have is a strongly merit-based position. You competed for that position and you're excelling in that position. And it's such an honor for us to have you in our community and for UCLA to have you on the faculty. It's a very, very special thing. You outcompeted a
Absolutely.
lot of domestic people for that job and based on merit. And if UCLA knew what it was doing, it would do everything that it could to make sure you could stay here forever. I'm not sure they're going to be able to pull that off with your deep roots in Mexico City. But just having you here for a year or two or five or whatever it ends up being is fantastic. So, David, thank you very, very much for taking the time to share your stories with us and congratulations on your achievements at UCLA. Before I let you go, I'm curious if your international perspective spills over into the advice that you give to prospective retina surgeons or to the current retina fellows in terms of what they should do in their training, take another year and go abroad, or what type of job they should get, or what type of research they should do. How does your international perspective bleed over into your advice?
It's a great question, and I've had that question asked a lot to me over the past couple of years. And I think the best advice that I could give anyone younger than me, because I'm still pretty young in my career, anyone younger than me, looking to move kind of forward in their career, expanding networks, maybe even achieving an international training program elsewhere, abroad, anywhere in the world, is, we almost always kind of look at research as something that we have to do, but we and those who have the passion for research, that's amazing. But there's the other side of medicine of people that don't really look at research as an opportunity, right? And I feel like first and foremost, if you have a passion for medicine and you have a passion for what you're doing, if you're thinking about money, if you're thinking about your financial success down the road, I don't think you're gonna do well in the meantime, because if you're only thinking about that, you're gonna overlook everything else that's going to actually get you there, right? So I think we have enough smart people in the world. I don't think we have enough hardworking people in the world. So I would, my best advice and concrete advice would be, don't always rely on intelligence. Rely on hard work, consistency, and discipline, and that will speak for itself. And that will go to show if you're intelligent or not. That really doesn't matter. It really matters how hard you work, how consistent you can deliver that work, and how much discipline you put into that work, how much love. And if you love what you're doing, that will open way more doors. And I can vouch for that, way more doors than being utterly intelligent and just using that to your favor. If you have both, even better. But if you can really, really work on the other types of intelligence, that will get you a long way. And that would be my definite advice.
And how do the trainees take to that?
So I think that the best way is, don't be afraid to reach out. That's something that I really, really learned. And if you want to, if you have the curiosity in your program, reach out, send an email, send your curriculum. Someone will be interested in seeing what you have to offer or including you in their program. And every opportunity could be a door to 10 more opportunities. So if you think the opportunity is worth it, even if it means sacrificing a big part of your lifestyle or a big part of what you thought you were going to do, more often than not, it will be rewarding. And I think that you should always, always try to kind of really push for that, even before trying to be famous or trying to be, financially stable. If you can work on that, that will get you there sooner. So
Yeah, that's
that would
great.
be my
And
piece of advice.
so, David, I know that you have achieved a tremendous amount of personal satisfaction from giving back and contributing both at the county hospitals and in the underserved populations and at the pinnacle of private care in Westwood. And I know that the research has contributed a lot to your satisfaction, the quality of care and the teaching. One other big piece of your Zen, which I really appreciate, is you wear your gratitude on your sleeve. So what I would like you to do is, if you'd like the opportunity to send a message in Spanish out to our listeners, in the Spanish-speaking world, as we close today.
That would be amazing. Y me encantaría saludar a mi gente en México, a todos mis colegas, oftalmólogos, retinólogos, médicos en general, decirles que los extraño muchísimo. He aprendido un sinfín y un mundo de cosas, no solo de medicina, sino de la vida en general, de cada uno de ustedes, toda la gente que ha estado cercana a mí, que me ha apoyado en este camino tan duro y tan largo, pero a la vez tan satisfactorio. Los tengo muy, muy cerca en mi corazón, los extraño, los quiero mucho y decirles que los espero aquí en Los Ángeles con mucha emoción y espero verlos pronto en la siguiente Junta o Congreso. Un saludo a todos.
Ya, y uno más por su papá.
Y bueno, sí, sin dejar afuera a mi queridísimo padre que me ha apoyado en este camino, que me ha enseñado tantas cosas de la vida y de medicina. Papá, te quiero mucho. Gracias por todo el apoyo. Eres mi más grande maestro y mi más grande admiración. Muchas gracias por todo.
Okay, gracias, David.
And Steve, a ti también te quiero decir muchas gracias por todo. Y te lo he dicho muchas veces, me has cambiado la vida. And thank you so much, Steve. Thank you so much.
Igualmente, por mí también. All right, guys, that's Retina Rounds podcast for today. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.